Happy Mother's Day. And my mom's here. Happy Mother's Day, Mom. My wife's here. Happy Mother's Day, Patty. And to all of you. It is a special day. And celebrating our mothers is celebrating a role that each of us cherishes. Each of us has received the gift of. And I was thinking of a blessing that was written by a man, John O'Donohue, that to me, I think it gets at that sort of intimate connection that we experience there. And so I thought I would read this to my mom, read this to all of you mothers today on Mother's Day. And for all of us that are cherishing that person in our lives, it says, "Mother, your voice learning to soothe your new child was the first home sound we hear before we could see. Your young eyes gazing on us was the first mirror where we glimpsed what to be seen could mean. Mother, your nearness tilled the air, an umbilical garden for the seeds of thought that stirred in our infant hearts. You nurtured and fostered this space to root all our quietly gathering intensity that could grow nowhere else. Mother, formed from the depths beneath your heart, you know us from the inside out. No deeds or seas or others could ever erase that. Amen." And so today, for Mother's Day, we are going to be reading a Psalm of Lamentation. I was thinking, oh gosh, you know, Lamentation for Mother's Day. But then I thought, maybe it is in some way sort of appropriate in the sense that I think our mothers, I know I could speak pretty safely for my own, had to do much lamenting on behalf of her son. That I think mothers carry a unique sort of care, and with it comes a unique form of suffering as they release their children out to the world and wonder just how well they're going to do. And lamentation is a part of life. It's a part of grieving. But I think mothers grieve in some ways uniquely. There is a proverb. Proverbs 10:1 says, "Wise children make their fathers proud of them. Foolish ones bring their mothers grief." And I was thinking, that's probably pretty accurate. You know, when our kids perform, it's the dad's like, "Yeah, that's my kid." And when they're not, the moms are like, "Oh, feeling the weight." And hopefully that's not actually an accurate explanation of our parenting. But there is, I think, a tenderness that a mother carries that manifests itself in a sort of heartbreak that comes in life that is, as it turns out, just a very normal part of life. I think that sometimes we have this illusion that maybe we can navigate through life without heartache, and this is just completely a fallacy, that it's built into the fabric of life, that to lead a meaningful life means a life of compassion, and to live a life of compassion necessarily includes with it heartbreak. Lamentation is a word that just means how. How? Like asked with a heart that is longing for an answer. And in our psalm today, we hear that as how long. The question will be asked four times in the passage. How long, Lord? How long? We know this, that there are certain sorts of suffering that come for a moment and then they're gone, and then others that we bear for long periods of time. They try us. They require endurance that we think we don't possess ourselves. They require perseverance that we find ourselves at least feeling incapable of. And we get to that point where we're thinking, "I can't, not one more day. That's it. I've hit my limit." And it's at that point that the lamentation comes out. How much longer? How long do I have to continue to bear this? Lamentations remind us that life is difficult, and learning to lament is critical for having a healthy, emotionally spiritual life. That if we don't know how to lament, then what we do is we repress, what we do is we stuff this And as a result of it, it just ends up manifesting itself in all kinds of hurtful and harmful ways. Heartbreak, again, is just a part of life. If you decide not to get married, you're going to experience suffering remaining single. If you do get married, you're going to find yourself going through seasons where the relationship is going to change. I'm going through premarital counseling with Ricky and Greg, who are getting married next week. And I was reading them this section where the guy was saying, look, you're going to marry the wrong person. It's just the way it is. Even though you think, oh, this person's perfect for me, you're going to grow and you're going to change and you're going to change in different ways. And you're going to experience suffering in your marriage, inevitably. You're going to decide that you want to have kids and maybe you're not going to be able to have kids and you're going to suffer. Or you're going to have kids and you're going to suffer. And then they're going to move out and you're going to suffer. Or maybe they won't move out. And right? You just go, this is unavoidable for us. Heartbreak is a part of life. Suffering is a part of life. And sometimes those seasons can last for a long time, even to the point where we think, no more, God, no more, I'm done. There's a quote that I have up here from David White, where he says, heartbreak is unpreventable, the natural outcome of caring for people and things over which we have no control. Heartbreak begins the moment we are asked to let go but cannot. In other words, it colors and inhabits and magnifies each and every day. Heartbreak is not a visitation but a path that human beings follow through even the most average life. Heartbreak is an indication of our sincerity in a love relationship, in life's work, in trying to learn a musical instrument, in the attempt to shape a better, more generous self. Heartbreak is the beautifully helpless side of love and affection and is in essence an emblem of care. Heartbreak has its own way of inhabiting time and its own beautiful and trying patience in coming and going. Psalm 13 is about this sort of heartbreak and heartbreak that lasts to the breaking point. And David here is going to ask God how long, and he's going to ask it from a heart that feels forsaken, overlooked, forgotten, which I think is some of the most painful sort of suffering. What we see David rightly do is he brings this suffering to God, and he's going to speak it with his whole heart. And as we read this, I think we are being shown and we are being taught how to lament. That we learn from this how to process through our grief, how to hold on to our suffering in such a way that we're able to transition through it, as we're going to see David do so beautifully. He's going to get to the point where he holds that before God, has perspective, and then is able to move through it to a point where his heart is rejoicing and filled with song. Every single lament has got this kind of basic flow to it. It starts with an address to God. Often what we see in that as we read David's words is there's a tenderness there and even a boldness that he feels to walk right up to the throne of God and say, here's my problem. The address is followed by a complaint, something that we see is wrong, an injustice or something that's being done that's out of balance, followed by a petition where we ask, God, here's what's wrong. This is what I need you to do. It's usually followed by some sort of additional argument, which oftentimes for David, it comes out as kind of something petty. And I love this about him, that he's just bearing everything. And as he's doing this, he's sort of leveraging these things with God, but there's a desperation to it and yet just an honesty and a transparency. And then there's always in this some sort of turn, some sort of change. And a lot of times we don't see why or how, it just occurs. Something happens in there. And this is important. We'll spend a little bit of time on that. What is going on there? But usually that change, that turn, is followed by a vow of praise. And then out of that, a hymn of blessing, where David finds himself moved to song. Let's read, it's a short one, Psalm 13, titled, How Long, O Lord? How long, O Lord, will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? How long must I take counsel in my soul and have sorrow in my heart all the day? How long shall my enemy be exalted over me? Consider and answer me, O my Lord. Light up my eyes, lest I sleep the sleep of death. Lest my enemy say I have prevailed over him. Lest my foes rejoice because I am shaken. But I have trusted in your steadfast love. My heart shall rejoice in your salvation. I will sing to the Lord because he has dealt bountifully with me. Amen. Now, I alluded to this earlier, but I think it's an important thing to reemphasize that Scripture isn't just a textbook. It's not filled just with information. It's a demonstration. It's a demonstration of how to live, how to pray, that it gives us permission. And one of the things that I love about the Psalms, and especially the Psalms of the Lament, is that they give us permission to be honest. And I think sometimes we need this because we have a tendency, all of us, to sort of write a psalm that would just focus on the good things, to say back or to repeat back those things that are going to get kind of the praise and affirmation of the group, as opposed to the real honest questions of the heart. Have you ever been a part of a Bible study where somebody raises their hand and goes, I have a question, and it's this, is that okay to ask? And sometimes, whether we know it or not, with our responses, we're going, no, we don't ask that question, right? But these questions, these deep questions that stir and trouble us, I think we can go for a season and not ask them. But when we find ourselves in this place of desperation, all of a sudden we find ourselves incapable of not asking those questions, of saying to God, okay, really? How much longer is this going to go on? And we see it in other people's lives when events happen and one thing after the other until we find ourselves almost on their behalf going, God, have mercy. But when that happens to us, it takes on a whole nother level or a whole nother texture to it. That not only do we find ourselves frustrated or angry or pushing back against God, but maybe even a little panicked. Have you felt that feeling? I'm thinking about, you know, this is a goofy example, but like in this martial arts class that I'm taking, Lila and I are taking it. she kicks my butt. But we'll do push-ups. And we'll do push-ups on and on. And you don't know how many. It's just that my teacher just keeps like one more, one more, one more. Until finally you're going, okay, that's the last one. Nope, another one. Okay, that's the last one. Until you're like, I can't do any more. No, one more. And you go, how long are we going to keep doing push-ups, right? You're feeling like on the verge of collapse. And I think that's almost sort of the texture of this. Like, I don't think I can keep going. That this thing that you're putting me through, God, is not sustainable. At some point, the wheels are going to fall off. And so that kind of panic comes out with almost a deep, like, groan of the heart. How much longer? One of my favorite books by C.S. Lewis is called A Grief Observed, where he's writing after he's lost his wife. And one of the first books Lewis wrote, maybe the first book, was The Problem of Pain. All about how to deal with hurt and wounds. Where is God in our pain? And all of a sudden, he finds himself 20 years later dealing with it on a whole nother level. And the things that come out in that book are so honest and so angry. And then every once in a while, like in one part, there's like a pause. And then he comes in and he goes, okay, last night that came out in a yell. And I think if I was him, I would have been like backspace or like select, you know, cut that out, right? Like, ugh, I was so angry right there. But I think I'm so glad he included that. I'm so glad that these psalms are here for us. Another writer that I like, Madeleine Lengel, says this about Lewis. She says, "I'm grateful to Lewis for having the courage to yell, to doubt, to kick at God in angry violence. This is a part of a healthy grief, which is not often encouraged. It is helpful indeed that Lewis, who has been such a successful apologist for Christianity, should have the courage to admit doubt about what he was so superbly proclaimed. It gives us permission to admit our own doubts, our own angers and anguishes, and to know they are part of the soul's growth." And this is the truth of the matter, that we can see doubt as like we're losing ground or we're forsaking something, when in fact what we're doing is asking the right questions and going deeper, moving further in. As we ask this question, how long, what we find ourselves doing is growing, and probably growing in ways that we would rather not. He feels abandoned by God. He feels like he's not being heard. And I think that feeling of loneliness, that is some of the worst suffering. He says something interesting in verse 2. He says, "How long must I take counsel in my soul and have sorrow in my heart all the day?" And as I think about this, I go, oh, that was for me, because that's what I do. When I feel pushed too far or when I feel overwhelmed, I take counsel in my soul. I go in. And part of me even enjoys this in a sick sort of way, where I'm going to figure this out. And to be totally honest, I go, all right, what's the worst case scenario? How do I prepare myself for that? So that I'm ready, I'm prepared. It's a way that I protect myself. I raise up my guard by thinking nothing's going to come at me that I haven't anticipated. But the thing is, when you retreat in, like what starts to happen, at least this is what happens to me, is the clouds just get darker and darker. Until pretty soon that worst case scenario becomes the world you're living in. It puts you in a place of isolation where you're removed and you're cut off. That's the only way to kind of survive in that, is to detach and to withdraw into our heart, to take counsel in our soul. And this is a dangerous thing for us. Now, there can be value there, but there can also be so much harm that occurs as we move back into that place where so often despair can set in, where we find ourselves isolated, and bitterness can creep in, and resentment. And if we don't come out of that place, we can do real deep harm. It doesn't just go away. I remember reading that, I think it was a book by Scott Peck, where he was saying that's the basis of every psychological disorder, is the false belief that maybe this will go away in time. And nothing does. And when we stuff it down there, that stuff just lurks down there like crocodiles. It comes out in ways. It comes out in ways physically. It comes out in ways where all of a sudden we find ourselves overreacting. We vent something to our kid and go, wow, what was that about? Right? Well, there's deep wounds. There's things in there that haven't healed. There's griefs that haven't been processed through. And so when we pull those things inward and leave them in there, we put ourselves at risk. I remember reading a book by Malcolm Gladwell a few years ago called Blink. And in Blink, he said that there was this guy that was saying he could, you know, with a 15-minute conversation with a couple, he could determine if you would be married in 5 years, I think was kind of the gist of it. Maybe getting some of the little details wrong there. But like a 15 or 30-minute conversation, and he could predict with 95% accuracy if that couple would be together in 5 years. Pretty impressive. You go, clearly a guy that can do that, 15 minutes, 30 minutes, knows exactly what he's looking for, and he did. He was looking for contempt and resentment. And he said if he could find that, even if it came out in jest with a couple, even if it came out with a smile, he went, oh, that's cancer. That's death. 5 years. And you go, oh, that's what happens. When we repress our grief, or our feelings, our emotions, when that goes down, right, it starts coming out in these ways that are hurtful and harmful that maybe we don't even see. And what God wants from us is a heart that's fully engaged, a heart that is free, a heart that can express those emotions, process through those. And David, a man after God's own heart, is demonstrating with us how to do it. And David is going to say, he's going to make his plea, and he's going to say, "Answer me, O Lord, light up my eyes." And I think he's right that the eyes, this is where the life is, this is where the soul becomes clear. But this idea of perception, I think, is so crucial in understanding our process through grief or our process through emotions, is when we pull these things out from our heart and express them like he's doing here. How long as these things come out, all of a sudden we're able to see them and we're able to see them for what they are. That the clouds, in a sense, break. And the sunlight that was being blocked out is all of a sudden able to penetrate through. That we start in this moment seeing the truth of the matter. We see them in light where our wounds don't have this megaphone voice. But we hear them for what they are. And so often that despair just gets put front and center when in fact, those fears are tiny little things. It's like mice to elephants, right? And those mice can cause a great deal of harm if the elephant responds to the mouse. But really, there's nothing that mouse can do other than scare the elephant. And I think so often our emotions and our suffering is like this. They bring us to what feels like the breaking point. When really, in fact, when we're able to see clearly, we see God is there and God has been with us and God will continue to be with us. When we see those things properly, we're able to see not only God with us in our present, but the way that God has been there again and again with us in our past. Faithfully walking us through situation after situation, fear after fear that either didn't manifest or some sort of answer came at the last moment, or some way, even when we experienced the difficulty, we received the comfort of his presence. I think of so many times that has happened for me, that's happened for my wife and I. And I always, after that, something, some financial thing hits and I just think, we're ruined. And then some answer comes unlooked for. Or some situation, even like when we moved here to Laguna, we had like 5 homes in 5 years. We kept switching from home to home and we'd be like, oh no, where are we going to live next? And like literally days before we were out of luck, all of a sudden, da-da, there came the answer. And I would find myself each time going, I'll never doubt again. If only that were true. If only I could keep my composure. But I think God has shown himself so faithfully. And I think when we will lament and we bring these emotions before God and we get angry, he's like, let me have it, all of it. David's like, I'm dying. God's like, I know, David, come on. And he's like, and besides, my enemies are rejoicing. And God's like, okay, whatever, give it to me. Give me all of this stuff, right? And you're going, even the petty stuff. I mean, David, who cares about your enemies rejoicing? But at the same time, God's going, just tell me what's on your heart. It makes me think of, I remember one time I was in 5th grade and my flag football team, we were losing because the other team was cheating, totally cheating. And I went to my teacher and I was telling him about it. And just in the middle of it, I started crying. And I look at that and I just go, oh, I'm so ashamed. So ashamed, this emotion that comes out of me, right? I cared so much and I was so embarrassed that I was crying. And I remember my teacher just being so gentle with me. And I think this is what God is like as we write these psalms of lament. God, I'm mad about this, and I'm upset about this, and I'm even jealous of this. And why am I jealous about that? I'm so stupid. And God's going like, it's okay. Tell me all of that stuff. And when we bring it out in the light, I think it's finally able to heal. This, can you flip a couple in there, Josh? There's one by, her name is Kathleen O'Connor. Yes, well done. Lamentation names what is wrong, what's out of order in God's world, what keeps human beings from thriving in all their creative potential. Simple acts of lament expose these conditions, name them, open them to grief and anger, make them visible for remedy. In its complaint, anger, and grief, lamentation protests conditions that prevent human thriving. And this resistance may finally prepare the way for healing. When we bring these things out, it can be humbling and humiliating and embarrassing, but it's honest and it's true, and it allows these things to heal. There's a part of me that doesn't want to leave behind my despair because it's my friend. It comforts me and says, Jeff, you're right. You're the victim. Jeff, you're right. Nobody understands you. You have the moral high ground. And for me to leave and bring these things honestly out into the open, I go, okay, I don't. I've got a lot of junk. And I think about when I feel this sort of suffering, whether it's with my children or if it's in my marriage or if it's in whatever situation, circumstances at work, when I feel these things that I don't want to deal and I hold them back, I keep myself small. And God's going to always push us to reengage. And when we do, we feel this sense of like, God, I can't do it. And I think God is going, you can. Like he says to Jeremiah, if you stumble when you're racing against men, how are you going to race against horses? Right? Like Jeff, you're stronger than this. You're stronger than you think you are. You're faster than you think you are. But you need to grow. And I think when we name these things and we heal, we grow. We find out that we can run faster than we thought. Our hearts are changed. Our pain is transformed into healing. And even that God uses for good. And we remember, we're encouraged because we see God's past faithfulness. We see his heart. We recognize that he loves us even at our worst, even at our lowest, even at our most desperate, even at our most embarrassing. That love is constant. It's constantly lifting us to our feet and telling us we can go on, we can continue on. As we do that, we grow. We gain in our generosity and our ability to love others, which is the point. That's what we've signed up for in this life. It is God's school of love. And his love can be trusted. Like David says, it's steadfast, it's unchanging. Even when we can't see it, it's there. And we can respond to it, we can count on it. We can put our faith in it boldly because God has been faithful and will continue to be. His ways are higher than ours. He knows our hearts better than we know them. He has plans and purposes not to harm us, but to bless us, to push us further in and to grow us. And when we see and experience this, it gives us more than just courage. It gives us joy. I think about this with Patty. If we move through something difficult and painful, and I'm able to get over something, maybe some sort of insecurity in my life, and I find on the other side a wife that I trust so much, my heart is filled with deep joy and gratitude for her and what a gift she is. When I process through some sort of difficulty with my children, when I get to the other side of that, this deep sense of gratitude, when I see God's faithfulness, gosh, that joy that it puts me in that place of such reassurance. And God is going, this is why. Like you engage through lament, through the grief, to that place of remembrance and trust. And out of that comes the desire in the heart to sing, which is how David would always end these laments. He would find and rediscover truth. His eyes would be enlightened to reality. And out of that, his heart would well up. One of my favorite little bits from Dallas Willard is he's going to go, like, when we love God with all of our heart, that means our mind and our emotions together. And I think nothing does that better than worship. And so I was thinking as we draw this to a close, how fitting it would be for us to respond with a song. how fitting it would be for us to sing. And as we do, to remember the faithfulness of God. As we sing, to be honest about the emotions that we carry, and yet to find God in that place, to sing, to remember, and to experience that joy.